CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Top story this hour, two different stories are coming out of Libya. Rebels claim they've brought the revolution to the capital of Tripoli, but the Libyan government says the rebels are losing every battle. CNN's Matthew Chan says he's been hearing heavy gunfire.
Last night, they couldn't hide from us the fact that there were these, you know, ferocious gun battles in various areas across Tripoli. And indeed, a government spokesperson came out later on in the evening and said, yes, there have been what he called small armed gangs, but they've been essentially brought under control.
The U.S. is trying to wind down the war in Afghanistan, but the new U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Ryan Crocker, says American forces could stay there beyond the 2014 deadline. Crocker says the drawdown can't be rushed.
We got it wrong in 1990, deadly wrong, because we were tired and we wanted to go home. Well, I know Americans are tired and want to go home again. We got to do it the right way. That's going to take some time, it's going to take some resources, and it's going to take some commitment.
People in Florida are being told to watch Tropical Storm Irene this week. Hurricane forecaster Robbie Berg says it's still a few days away.
It does look like Irene could approach the Florida Peninsula either late Thursday or Friday. There's still a lot of uncertainty in the forecast that long from this time.
There is a hurricane watch for Puerto Rico. Shots were fired in the parking lot after the 49ers-Raiders preseason game in San Francisco last night. Two people were shot and one of them might die. The two Americans being held in Iran were sentenced to 8 years in prison for spying, according to state-run media. The lawyer for Josh Fatal and Shane Bauer says he's hoping for leniency because this is the holy month of Ramadan. Fatal and Bauer have already spent 2 years in one of Iran's most notorious prisons. For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
There are a million reasons Staples makes going back to school easy. Today's reason? A free $100 Visa prepaid card via Easy Rebate when you buy a student laptop and show a current school ID. This incredible offer means your student can start school with a powerful new Windows laptop. It also means you won't have to hear,
"You're giving me your old laptop, Mom? It's so big."
At Staples, you'll find four powerful and portable student laptops from HP, Dell, and Toshiba. Even the amazing Samsung Princeton with the new Intel Core technology.
"Hey, Mom, the X key is missing." "That's not an important letter, I guess."
And don't forget the $100 Visa prepaid card. Just be sure you take advantage of this offer soon.
"Mom, what is a floppy disk?"
Who knows? With that free $100 Visa prepaid card from Staples, you might be surprised at what you hear.
"Hey, thanks, Mom."
Who says money can't buy love? Staples. That was easy. Visa card issued by JPMorgan Chase Bank N.A. pursuant to a license from Visa USA Incorporated. Terms and conditions apply to the card. Details at staples.com/student-off.
There is a watchmaking standard that is revered around the world. That standard comes from Rolex. From clasp to bracelet to its unique watertight oyster case, a Rolex holds its value because it was intended to. Crafted from just three precious metals, platinum, steel, and gold, each defies the ordinary. Its steel, 904L, virtually indestructible and corrosion resistant, is incomparable. Its patented Everrose Gold, created in an exclusive foundry, will remain beautiful for life. Inside, a genuine Rolex movement is a product of superiority and remarkable testing. It is unrivaled. At Rolex, flawless standards create more than a watch. They create a value that was meant to endure. For a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Torno, the world's largest watch store since 1900. Torno, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
Policies issued by American General Life Insurance Company, Houston, Texas. Not available in all states. For details, visit matrixdirect.com.
Sometimes I worry about what would happen to my family if I lost my job. But I never really thought about what would happen to them if they lost me and I didn't have life insurance. My cousin's husband died, and now she might have to sell her house just to make ends meet. I don't ever want to put my wife through that. So I called Matrix Direct.
Hi, I'm Brent Langdon for Matrix Direct. We partnered with American General Life to find you their lowest rates on term life insurance products. If you're 40 years old and married, we could find you a $250,000 policy for less than $16 a month. Call now for a free, no obligation quote. 1-800-588-5514.
I feel so much better now that I called.
It only takes 5 minutes to see how you could save up to 70%. Call now. 1-800-588-5514. 1-800-588-5514.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles, and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcasting from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. And this is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, Ed O'Lara, with Buchanan Ingersoll and Rooney. And we have a great lineup of guests for you on our show today, including Glenn Hazard, who's the chairman and CEO of Exceedium, Paul Lombardi, the president and CEO of TerraThink, Therese Baker, president of Abtech Professional Resources, and Jeff Smith, principal with Baker and Tilly. First up is a gentleman by the name of Glenn Hazard, who's the chairman and CEO of Exceedium. What is Exceedium, Glenn?
Exceedium is a privately held software security company that focuses on delivering privileged access management solutions to its customers.
Privileged access management solutions. Just what exactly is that?
Think of the need for people with higher or heightened credentials needs to access critical infrastructure and data as people that we focus on making sure that they get access to those things in a secure way.
Why is that so important today?
So important today. You have many examples like WikiLeaks and other Stuxnet and other things where you've had many a person have access to critical data without the authority to do so. And so we actually control that access. We monitor that access. We actually provide feedback to our customers. It allows them right down to the keystroke to know what every user is doing as they access those critical.
How long has the company been around?
Company was actually founded in 1999 with professional investment made in 2005.
Wow. And when did you become associated with them?
I became associated with the company in January 2010 as a consultant and joined the company as the chairman and CEO in June of 2010.
And what's it been like?
It's been a fun ride. You can do as much due diligence as you can think that you would do prior to these engagements, and then frankly, once you're in, you find the real truth is yet to be shed. So, it's been an interesting trip.
Is this your first time with this sort of adventure?
No, I think I'm a masochist here. The answer is I've done this several times.
Why? What is it? What makes this kind of thing so interesting to you?
That's the challenge. It's fun. It's challenging. It's rewarding. It's the unknown. It's learning every day when you get up and you go to work. The new experiences and exposure that you get is phenomenal.
So take us back to where the first time that you tried this out.
First time I tried this was when I actually. Within a large organization, the first time I tried this was back when I worked at AT&T, and there was a failing division within the company that actually required major modifications. And somehow I was chosen to be moved from a sales leadership position into a role of actually leading that turnaround or literally that change.
Oh, wait a minute. From a sales leadership position, sales manager, VP sales, into a turnaround position, an ops kind of thing.
Absolutely.
What do you think they saw in you that made you the ideal pick?
The conversation at the time, as I recall, with the CEO of the company was, Glenn, you have continued to be successful managing sales for us for a number of years. You have rapport with large amounts of the business already. Number two, if we think about the one most critical ingredient that's going to be required to change the business the way it needs to be changed, we're going to need someone to sell the organization on that change. And who better than to grab someone who's got the sales experience, who has rapport with those individuals? Let's try leading. We've tried leading with engineering. That didn't work. We've tried leading with finance. That didn't work.
How did it turn out?
Turned out great. 19 months after we started, we had our first profitable quarter. Some Harvard Business Review articles were written about the turnaround.
How did you learn to sell?
How did I learn to sell? I learned to sell back when I was in college. It was a need to survive, a need to pay tuition. Going to school full-time and working full-time was a challenge, and so I chose sales as my avenue to get to the money.
What kind of sales?
Actually, insurance sales.
And how old were you when you were doing this?
I was doing that when I was 19 years old.
19-year-old selling what kind of insurance?
And selling life and health insurance. A challenge with the name of Hazard. that is where I started.
Yeah. So how does a 19-year-old get someone to buy that kind of insurance?
In order to get someone to actually sit at the table with you, and that was really what most of it was sitting around the table with a husband and a wife and talking about their insurance needs. It really was just opening a dialogue with them, getting a conversation going, and then listening, just letting them talk.
Yeah, but isn't it a little unusual for a family to be buying insurance from a 19-year-old?
You would think it's unusual. Again, I would just say that getting the appointments was not that difficult to me over the phone. And then once you got the appointment, sit down with them, explain a little bit about your background, that you're going to school, and impressing them right away that you knew something about the product. You knew something about what their need might be. Because, again, we were trained in the beginning when we started working for the insurance company.
But what made you effective at it, other than just tenaciousness and a willingness to make the calls? Were you believable? And what about it was believable?
Yeah, believable because, frankly, by listening to what they would tell me, if I played it back to them in a way that you could tell, if you watch the body movement, if you listen to the words, I think you can play back to someone exactly in a meaningful way what it is that's important to them.
But that's an amazing skill, to be able to listen that way, look at body language, and to know at 19 that's what you're supposed to do is a skill that takes many people an entire lifetime to learn. How did you do that?
I feel like it was a lifetime of experience. When I wanted to wear a particular thing to school, I learned to iron so that I could wear it. When I wanted a particular food to be at the dinner table, I learned to cook. You learned at an early age that if you really wanted particular things, you needed to take the initiative.
What was going on early in your life that you learned this kind of self-sufficiency?
A middle son with brothers and sisters the oldest that got seemed to get most of the attention, the youngest that seemed to get the other part of the attention, and you in the middle that kind of always got hand-me-downs and so on. You learned that you put the first foot forward or you don't. The view never changes.
Well, you've had numerous opportunities. You've run a number of companies. Why did you select this company?
I selected this company actually from an outside-in perspective. This is a company that when I was asked to join it, it was to really assess for the investors, what do we do with the company? Further investment? Shall we sell the company? And through an analysis of where I thought the market demand was, talking to a lot of the customers, what I recognized was there was a great market demand. There was extreme customer loyalty. When a customer says to you, I'd throw your product out of here if I could find anyone else's product to do what yours does, is on one side, a frustrated customer, I can address those things. But when they make a comment that you have something that no one else has, then I have some competitive advantage in a market.
So you were doing exactly what you were doing back when you were 19, just listening really good.
Just listening. As I said before, if you really just, it is the single most important skill, from my perspective, that anyone could possess.
You mentioned when you were at another company, you were the only person speaking. Your position was between the CEO and others, and you found out that the two senior executives had different agenda. What did you learn from that?
You learned to pay attention again, very very carefully, to which objectives each one of them had, and you had to be sure that in fact you fulfilled or met the objectives of both of them, yet at the same time maintaining the integrity with each. Not easy to do, but in fact it's possible, again, if you really pay attention and and you understand the situation that you're in.
How do you prevent that from happening in a company like you're building now?
You prevent that. You can prevent that very easily, in my opinion, by just presenting an atmosphere of collaboration where I don't put people at odds with one another in terms of the objectives that I give them. I don't intentionally create an environment of conflict with any of them. Frankly, I act more as a coach and let them, with their discrete responsibilities, make their decisions rather than put them in a contentious spot.
You've been the CEO of both venture-backed companies and publicly traded companies.
That's correct.
Those appear to me to be two different skill sets altogether.
They are. They're two very, very different environments. When you're on quarterly calls with Wall Street and your constituents are quite a bit different than the constituents within a small privately held company, they're worlds apart in lots of ways, as much as perhaps the functional responsibilities and the challenges. A lot of the challenges are the same. The environments and the requirements of both are very, very different.
Yeah. Which one do you prefer?
I definitely prefer the private company, the smaller company.
Why?
The less bureaucratic. Time to make change. Your ability to impact the business mm-hmm. is immediate. The constituents, as I said, are different. There's very different motivation, very different timing, very different dynamics.
Right. What's been your proudest moment up till now?
Proudest moment. Proudest moment was actually probably making each one of these companies that I've had a chance to work with so far anyway successful.
Mm-hmm. What's the web address, Glenn, for Excedium?
www.excedium.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Glenn Hazard, who's the chairman and CEO of Excedium. I'd like to thank my co-host Ed Allera with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me structure the interview today. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this important business spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
McKenna Henry of Smart CEO Magazine.
McKenna, what is Smart CEO Magazine?
Smart CEO Magazine is a regional publication that aims to inspire, motivate, and educate mid-Atlantic CEOs.
And what else should we know about the magazine?
Smart CEO reaches 45,000 CEOs in the Mid-Atlantic with three distinct publications in Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. areas.
But you're here to talk about something very specific and special that Smart CEO is doing soon.
I am, Mike. Yes, the annual G3 Growth Conference will be hosted on November 10th at the Washington Hilton in Washington, D.C.
Who should be there?
Everyone up and down the Mid-Atlantic who is leading their business, all chief executives, CXOs of Mid-Atlantic businesses looking to grow their companies.
And the takeaway will be what?
C-level executives who attend will hear from noted authors, well-respected national CEOs and industry experts, and will take away new insights and actionable items to apply to their businesses.
Now, you call this a conference. How is this different than the Smart CEO events that most of us attend each month?
Smart CEO is known for our awards events where we will profile and recognize CEOs based on their leadership. However, the G3 Growth Conference is much more of an informational platform where C-level executives will learn new insights and takeaway items to apply.
Can you give us the date and the location again, please?
Sure. It is November the 10th, 2011, at the Washington Hilton in Washington, D.C.
We've been speaking with McKenna Henry of Smart CEO Magazine and the G3 Conference. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. Broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, Ed Allera, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Paul Lombardi, who's the president and CEO of TerraThink Corporation. What is TerraThink Corporation?
TerraThink Corporation is an 8A certified IT and management consulting firm with a primary focus on the federal government. We provide enterprise solution, strategy definition and planning, implementation, integration, and operations and maintenance services.
When did the company get started?
2002, the company was founded.
Did you found the company?
I did.
How big or small is it today?
We have about 90 employees, including our subcontract partners and 1099s. Our 2010 revenue was around $15 million, and we're growing.
Mm-hmm. And you started the company in 2002.
Yes, I did.
I understand you've won a number of accolades recently, including fastest growing company on Inc. 500.
We did. We won 24th fastest growing company in Washington Technology Fast 50. For a third year in a row, we've made that list. And we also made the Inc. 500 list again this year, and the number is TBD, but we anticipate it will be pretty low.
And why is it that you're so successful?
Well, I think the reason why our company's so successful is because we've taken great energy and time and made a major investment in recruiting and retaining the right people. A lot of our business has been grown organically through repeat business, and the reason that it's become a repeat business is because our customers are 100% satisfied.
So are you saying it's more about the people than the product?
I think a product is a byproduct of our people. We're in a services industry, so everything, the services that we provide ultimately are the deliverables for our customers. Mm-hmm.
So why start a company in the first place?
My first career was with Anderson Consulting, now Accenture, and in the late 90s, I chose to join a very small consultancy. It was the opportunity was seemed very exciting. I got into the Oracle application space, and when I made the transition, I just loved the speed and the flexibility, the dynamic nature, and the ability to get involved in things that I normally wouldn't get involved in a much larger business. And I had the opportunity to see a company grow from very small through acquisition, and then be brought back into taking on some responsibility on a sales side. So I thought that, you know, I had seen the world from a business development perspective, and why not go start my own business?
You mentioned you had a mentor who mm-hmm. helped you.
Yes.
How did that come about?
When I left Anderson and joined this small consultancy, the founder of that company took me and a couple others under his wing and really provided mentorship through the term of that company, and then brought us back into another company to provide that business development expertise. When that company was then acquired, I had the opportunity. I told that founder of that company that I'm going to go start my own company, and he said, "You know, Paul, relax. Why don't you cool your jets a little bit? I'm going to go start my own company, a third company, and I'll have you come support me, and I'll show you how to build a business from zero to whatever, and when you think the time's right, you can move on and focus on TerraThink." So we did just that, and we grew that company to about $15.5 million in 2.5 years, and it was then acquired by a large systems integrator. And from there, I moved on and focused on TerraThink.
One of the hardest things to do is to put the brakes on. How did you have the discipline to do that and say, I'm going to stay with this gentleman?
You know, at the time I thought I was being very conservative, and I viewed it as, I didn't view it as much value as I do now. I had the opportunity to see so many different aspects of a business, from those initial days of 1 to 5 people to 5 to 10 and 10 to 20, 20 to 50, and all those different plateaus required a different discipline. I didn't realize the benefit that I was gaining during the time, but I continued to thrive in taking on different responsibilities within the organization.
What do you think the mentor saw in you?
I think he saw that I was committed, that I would put into whatever I needed to do to make things a success, and I was very entrepreneurial. I was involved in, you know, I'd seen all aspects from the delivery side on consulting. I helped get involved in defining methodologies, to defining new practice areas and service lines. And I think he saw a genuine interest in growing something and a true entrepreneurial spirit.
Where did the entrepreneurial thing come from? How early was that operating in you?
Well, in high school and college, I always had a lawn care program that I was involved in, that I ran. I was the foreman. I did similar things in college through the student painters. But really, I think the entrepreneurial drive came into play when I joined that first small business after Anderson. And again, just the culture, the excitement, and seeing things grow and seeing that direct impact really, really had that the impact on me to continue to focus on in an entrepreneurial setting.
Where do you suppose you learned how to lead?
Well, early, you know, I've always been interested in taking leadership responsibilities. In fact, I was in my elementary school. I was the first president of the class, and I did continue on with that through high school and focusing in student council. I also took leadership roles in all the sports that I played. And I think so very early on, I took leadership responsibility. Leadership roles.
Why? You know, grammar school, that's early on. So
you know, I don't know. Maybe it was. I've always been extroverted and outgoing. I think maybe it's just part of my DNA. But I've always been interested in those types of positions.
Mm-hmm. What's fun about it?
What's fun is getting people interested in a common objective and getting everybody to think down the same path and work towards a common goal. And then when you get towards that goal, seeing the successes that you that the whole team reaps from it.
Yeah. What other important business influences have you had along the way?
My father has played a major role in my career and my career development. He was very successful. He started in the government, was very successful as he transitioned out of the government into the private sector and, you know, moved on into taking owner or leadership of DynCorp through the acquisition by CSC. So, you know, having that entrepreneurial background through my one mentor, complemented by a very big business background, has really hit. My father's been a tremendous, provided a wealth of knowledge and a tremendous set of values to support my growth.
What do you suppose the influence of your mother was on you?
You know, my mother grew up in a very, very, very modest background, and she had always taught me to be diligent and to persevere. So I think that she's instilled a discipline, a very strong-willed discipline, and provided me a background for growth.
You mentioned, well, you were originally trained as an engineer, and then you went to work for a large consulting firm.
Yes.
Which gave you training. How would you compare them? There's this debate about, I think Gates is giving people money to just start ideas and not go to college.
How would I compare engineering to consulting?
To what you learned in the training they gave you.
Well, I think an engineering background gives a good platform for analytical problem solving, regardless of what that problem is. And in our consulting, in the initial stages of consulting, that's exactly what we're doing. In fact, the original program that I supported was the large satellite communications phones. Iridium was the Iridium phone. We were building a solution to help develop, to support the rate plans, customer care, and so on. So every day we were challenged with a new problem, how to overcome that problem. And a lot of that problem solving was very analytical. So I think more than making a direct relationship, I think the engineering discipline gave me the tools to excel in consulting.
You rep this like it was a very methodical, planned out, sequential kind of a thing. There had to be some big challenges along the way that you overcame. Why don't you talk about a few of those?
Oh, absolutely. As far as starting the business, I'm
any of them. What were some of the obstacles you had to overcome?
Well, I think you know, take you back to the engineering. It was touch and go in the first year whether or not we're going to stay in the program, but. I did. I continued with that. I'm very glad that I did. I think in the early stages of the company, we had no business. You're making calls from your basement, hoping that the dogs don't bark and run your sales call. It was touch and go. And I remember talking to my wife at the time and said, psychologically, this could cripple me if we do not, you know, we're not successful.
Yeah, so you were starting a family at the time, too. Is that correct?
So right as we decided to transition into full-time focus on TerraThink and not take a salary, we had just moved into a new house and just had twins. So my wife wasn't working, and it was very, very challenging. And I think that probably had a lot to do with it because there was no room. There was no we had we We couldn't not succeed.
Yeah, what do you think your wife saw in you that let her have the confidence that it would be okay?
My wife is a saint when it comes to accommodating what we're doing, and I think she always had faith, and she was always very supportive of everything that I did. There wasn't a lot of selling at that regard, but it was I had her devoted support.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what she saw in me, but I'm glad that she did stick with me through it.
What do you think your mom and dad would say if I was interviewing them right now about you? Would they be surprised? What would they say?
Surprised? I don't think they would be surprised. My dad challenged me pretty hard, and he still does as part of my advisory board. He always puts objectives, loftier than they should be. But I think they'd say that they're very proud of what we've accomplished.
What's the website address for TerraThink, Paul?
It's www.terrathink.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Paul Lombardi, who's the president and CEO of TerraThink Corporation. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me structure the interview today. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to listen to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this important business spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Aaron Munley.
Aaron, who are you with?
The Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce.
And you're here to talk about a special event, is that right?
Right. Our Education Foundation is hosting a very fun and special event on August 30th. It's a karaoke event, Charity Karaoke for Education.
And who should be involved in this event?
It's a really great opportunity for anyone in Fairfax County to come out to support our public school system.
And they will have to do what exactly?
Well, no one will have to do anything, but attendees at the event will certainly have an opportunity to go up on stage to sing a karaoke song to raise money for education.
So tell us how the money-raising part of this works.
Well, you'll come to the event and you'll volunteer as a singer, and then what we'll do is members of the business community will bid to send you up on stage, and their donations will go straight to Fairfax County Public Schools.
And who gets to pick the songs?
The singers are allowed to pick their songs, or if they allow the bidders to pick the songs, then that would be fine, too.
Have you ever done an event like this before?
We really haven't, and it's the only one in our area this summer, so we really encourage everyone to come out.
So you said it's for the Fairfax County Public Schools. Tell us why that's such a good cause.
Well, businesses really work hand-in-hand with education. The folks that are educating our students today are building our future workforce of tomorrow. So as a business community, it's our responsibility to support our public schools.
So if someone wanted to get involved and sing at this event, how do they learn more? How do they get signed up?
It's very easy, Mike. Just go to our website, www.fairfaxchamber.org, right on the homepage.
And give us again the date, et cetera.
It is on Tuesday, August 30th from 6 to 9, Westwood Country Club on their pool deck.
We've been speaking with Aaron Munley of the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, Ed Alera, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young lady by the name of Therese Baker, who's the president of a company called Abtech Professional Services, or Resources, I'm sorry. What is Abtech Professional Resources?
We're an employment services company, recruiting and hiring top talent for companies who need to hire top talent.
How long have you guys been around?
Since 1992.
1992. How big or small are you today?
We're about 25 million with 310 field employees and about 42 staff employees.
310 field employees. That's a pretty good sized company.
Yes, and nationwide. We're in 46 states.
And what do you specialize in as a staffing company?
Information technology, professional backgrounds, administrative, and we're also the only staffing company that has HSPD-12. Which is credentialing on our GSA schedule.
I'm not sure what HSP, what does that mean?
That is government mandated that every government employee has a government issued badge. Mm-hmm. So Homeland Security Presidential Directive 12, Bush signed, that said every government employee has a badge. So we have experience in actually credentialing those employees to get badges.
So this is a pretty tough economy. How's the staffing company doing?
We're doing great. And thank God. we have a number of clients who come to us who aren't ready to hire full-time employees, so they have short-term projects, or they hire them through us first and try them out to see if they work out and then convert them to direct hire.
Mm. When did you join the company?
I joined in 2001.
Why?
It's a family-owned business, so my mother-in-law, Kathleen, father-in-law, Robert, asked me to come in and do some procedures and policy work, and I said sure, and then I came in, and I haven't left.
And why?
One, it's a family-owned business, so of course, being your family-owned business, the family is important, and you want to make sure that, you know, we keep everybody employed, in addition to the family, also our employees.
Well, not everybody wants to work with the family. Why is that okay for you?
I think it's because we all have the industry in our background, and we all have a different position in the company, so we're not really butting heads.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a background in staffing?
I do. I have 25 years in the recruiting industry.
How'd you get started?
I started with Unisys right out of high school.
Right out of high school?
Right out of high school.
Why?
My stepmother told me that I either had to find a job or get out. So 2 weeks before graduation, I canvassed the area, and I came across Sperry, which in turn became Unisys, applied, and they accepted me, and I started.
So at 19, with no formal training, no
Correct.
College degree, you get thrown into recruiting.
Correct.
What was that like?
Exciting, scary, but I think it's one of those things where you say yes and figure it out later.
Were you successful?
Yes, yes. I'm a survivor, so that's what we do.
You're a survivor. Say something about that.
I had to get a job. I had to make money. I had to find a place to live. And the only way to survive is really to do what you're asked to do and get good at it.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get good at it?
Just doing it over and over again, asking people, learning from other people, reading. And, you know, people are people. So setting structure in place when you talk with them and help them find a position.
Is this the first time you had to survive?
No, I feel like I've been a survivor all my life.
How early was that going on?
I guess since I was a child.
Say a little more.
I came from a blue-collar background, so we didn't always have a lot of money. So mm-hmm. we had to figure out, grew up on a farm, mm-hmm. had to figure out where our food was coming and how to keep ourselves warm. Mm-hmm. So you make things happen.
Yeah, what do you think you were learning about yourself looking back on it, having to do that?
That I'm strong. But I'm also compassionate because I understand where people can come from and their perceptions of people. And sometimes you don't know what that perception is until you get to know them. So I like to get to know people and find out about them.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you have a large staff and then about 10 times that in the field. How do you convey leadership to those people? How do you keep them in line?
That's a great question. The way our staff is set up, they have contacts at our company, the salesperson or the recruiter, but we have started having communication with them on a monthly basis by sending them emails, or I even pick up the phone and I'll call them. If they're a new employee, I'll call and say who I am and glad you're on board. So it takes effort, but we're trying to improve that because they are spread out so much and they don't really get to see us.
You talked about earlier, you got this from somebody in your family, the difference between return on relationship and return on investment. Tell us about that.
My father-in-law has a great saying where he says, if people like you, they may do business with you. If they don't like you, they will never do business with you. So I look at it as a return on relationship. If you connect with somebody on a personal level, you will keep that relationship going, and you never know when you may help each other in the future. And I believe you got to give to get. So I will help anybody who asks me, and then hopefully when I call in a favor, they'll be there to help me out.
So how do you keep relationships intact among 310 employees?
Again, it can be difficult, but you know, letting them know we're here, the communication on a monthly basis, if anybody calls the company and someone's not available, they can ask for me. I'll take the call. I'll talk with them. I do like to call our field employees on a regular basis, and I'm starting to do that weekly, maybe calling four or five at a time.
Mm-hmm. When did you become president?
In January of this year.
Why do you think you're the ideal pick at this point in time, other than the fact that you're a family member? What makes you the perfect person to run this business?
I've basically been doing the job for the past couple of years, and I think I've proven to my father-in-law and my mother-in-law that I can handle the financial side of the business in addition to the personal side and the structure of how to run a business. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean I know everything. And experience is a very expensive teacher, and sometimes we've had some expensive lessons, but I think as long as we learn and we don't make the same mistake again, it works out.
Tell us about the most expensive lesson you had to learn, if you can.
Oh, my goodness. There was a lawsuit where somebody had claimed one of our employees violated their employment agreement, which they didn't, but we had to fight it. and that's very expensive. So we've changed our structure internally to make sure that, do you have a non-compete? Can you work here? If you do, sorry, you can't work here.
What are some of the biggest challenges you think face you going forward?
The economy. I think it's the economy and just the communication to the employees, because they're all concerned as well. And how do you, you know, support that with the debt ceiling talk and the continuing resolution? We had a lot of concern because we were a government contractor. So we were very much in communication with the field employees.
Yeah, I can imagine a workforce getting a little distracted mm-hmm. with all that stuff going on. How do you keep them focused?
We reinforce the task at hand. And they're appreciative. I mean, most of them are glad to have jobs, which isn't always the best solution, because you want to have a job that you enjoy doing. And we try to find other positions if they learn new skills. We've also set up a training program to help them get new skills and get certifications.
Mm-hmm. What are you looking for when you recruit these people?
My personal model is that you have to have a personality, you have to have a great attitude, and some skill. I can't change your personality, I can't give you an attitude, but I can teach you skill. So if you can give me those two first things, personality and attitude, then I'm going to give you a shot.
You mentioned in the green room that you have six family members in the business. What's
yes.
it like to have six family members in the business?
Thanksgiving dinners are interesting. No, it's great. We all get along. The reason we get along is because we all have different positions. We don't do the same job. And if there's a business decision that needs to be made, we come together and we make the decision. Usually major decisions, minor ones aren't, you know.
Well, you mentioned that at times you use consensus and at times you use collaboration. How do you decide?
Depends on the impact of the decision to the organization. If the impact is large, then we usually have a meeting and decide which avenue to take. Sometimes we have plan A, plan B. And we kind of see what happens during a period of time as to whether we execute plan A or plan B.
How has staffing changed over the years?
My gosh, the compliance is much higher. It's no longer place an employee and it works, because that's always magical. But now there's laws and regulations that you have to follow and make sure. So the compliance is the biggest thing, but it's still the same industry. You got a job, you have a person. Is there a match? You put them to work.
How has technology impacted the industry?
There is so much information readily available today that you can find a candidate. I can find a candidate in a minute, whereas before you'd have to pick up the phone, you'd have to run an ad. But now there's Twitter and Facebook and everything like that. So finding candidates are easy.
Where do you want to take this company?
That's a great question. I think the family's deciding that right now. We had a goal 5 years ago to be $30 million, and we met that goal. And now it's time to set a new goal. And so now we have to have a family discussion to set that new goal. Major decision impacts the organization.
Do you think it's about size, getting bigger?
That's where we may have a disagreement, because I think it's more about sustainability. A lot of companies can bring in revenue, but what about profit?
Right. I mean, do you worry about – it sounds to me like you really value the quality of the relationships.
Yes.
I mean, how big does a company get before that becomes at risk?
That's a good question, because I think we may be struggling with that now. Mm-hmm. Because you're losing that personal relationship because you are getting so large. So we need to figure out where we want to go and what we want to do with it.
Yeah.
Do you think you got an advantage by working your way up from the bottom?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I had a number of people who had faith in me, who taught me. I learned by hard knocks. But again, it's always say yes and figure it out later. And I'm a survivor, so I'm a structured person. I like policy.
Say yes and figure it out later. That's a heck of an
exactly.
attitude. So what's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
Wow, the toughest thing. I've had a number of things in my life. Getting my education. Unisys paid for my education, and I will always, always be grateful for that. It took me 8 years to get my associate's degree, and I did. Would I go back and get a bachelor's? No. No, because I think my experience really drives
it. How about your proudest moment up till now?
My proudest moment? I would say probably becoming president of ABTECH, because that shows that my in-laws are comfortable in the next generation and believe in our skills and know that we can do it. And I think that we've proven that we can take the business forward.
Well, good luck taking it into the next generation. And what's the website address, Therese?
It's www.abtech.com.
Great. We've been speaking with Therese Baker, who's the president of Avtech Professional Resources. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Allaire, with Buchanan Ingersoll and Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is?
Ernest Foreman.
Ernest, who are you with?
I'm with the George Washington University.
And you do what exactly for the George Washington University?
I'm a professor, and I teach in the project management program.
And you're here to talk about that program, is that right?
That's correct.
Tell us about it.
Well, the project management program at GW is one of the first project management programs in a business school. It has two distinguishing characteristics. One is it teaches generalized project management, not for a specific industry, such as the airline industry or construction industry. Another distinguishing characteristic is that we have an online component of the program, which is one of the first online project management programs, that is indistinguishable in content from the on-campus program. So the students that take the courses on campus or online have the same material. In fact, some students even alternate between on-campus and online.
Is there something significant about offering a general rather than specific to the industry project management program?
Well, the underlying theory and methodology of project management pertains to any type of industry. And so the students learn more about these other industries, which help them think more about their own industry, and also gives them more flexibility in job opportunities in the future.
In a few seconds, the ideal candidate for this program would be whom?
Somebody who has a bachelor's degree. The person may or may not already be in project management, but would like to learn more about project management and perhaps consider it as a career.
Give us the web address, please.
The web address is gw.edu, and if you click on the business school, then you'll find the project management program.
And this has been your business spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, Ed Allaire, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Jeff Smith, who's a principal with Baker and Tilly. What is Baker & Tilly?
Baker & Tilly is a public accounting firm focused on audit and tax commercially, but also advisory services and a long, long history, recently entering the federal market.
Mm-hmm. How long has the firm been around?
It's been around about 80 years, 1931.
80 years, that's a long time. How big or small is it today?
In the U.S., we're about 1,700 staff, and in the top 20 of accounting firms, and globally, we're like the eighth largest accounting firm in
wow.
the global network.
When did you join?
I joined just under a year ago, so I'm coming up on my anniversary here very soon.
Oh, congratulations. And why? Why Baker Tilly?
I had an opportunity to come in and help them build and lead the federal practice, and to me that was a very exciting thing.
Build the federal practice?
A small bit of federal work there, but I think there was a desire to bring someone in with a deep federal background and mm-hmm. As far as from an advisory and consulting perspective.
Right.
And my role was to come in and help build a strategy and build the team and start to execute and grow this practice.
Other than maybe a nice resume, what makes you the ideal pick?
Great question. I think I do have the desire to do this. I think I have the desire to move from what I learned both in a partnership model at PricewaterhouseCoopers and PricewaterhouseCoopers, then learned in a public model at IBM, and decided to come over here and decide to take that entrepreneurial kind of spirit and bring it back in this environment, work with a great group of folks, and build the practice.
Well, you're picking probably one of the most difficult economic environments of our generation.
Timing is tough, yes. Yeah.
What makes you think you can do it?
Well, I think when you're starting from a relatively small base of work and you're still dealing with a federal government that, while they're going to go through a series of cuts, there's still $70 billion worth of dollars that are out there. There's a need, even in a downturn, for them to hire folks and help them improve their performance, help them work through risk issues that they may have, help them work with financial management issues. And I think we certainly can do that. And we may not be like some of the large systems integrators who want to go build the next system, and those programs are under scrutiny for the dollars they have, but we can help an auditor, we can help a CFO come in and help them understand how to do their business more efficiently, look for fraud, waste, and abuse, any number of activities that kind of help in this kind of budget environment that they're in.
Yeah, so step us back to how you've prepared yourself for this. What type of jobs and careers have you been up to since then?
So out of college, I had a military career. I think that was great in building leadership capabilities.
And what branch of the military?
I was in the Marine Corps. I was a pilot, and it was great for understanding how to take the leadership role, marshal folks around an idea, push them forward, understand the balance you need to have between the strategic and the tactical, kind of setting a long-term perspective, but at the same time learning how to execute on a day-to-day basis.
Why the Marines?
My father was a Marine. I was inspired by them. I thought they were the best service around. I wanted to be a pilot. I had an opportunity to do both.
When did you realize you wanted to be a pilot?
Probably somewhere in the beginning of high school days. I had that kind of...
Was there something happened that I realized?
My dad had a Piper Cub when I was really little, and you know, I apparently don't have the memory of this because I was too small of a child, but he always had an interest in aviation, couldn't afford it, I think, once I came along and ate him out of house and home. and ultimately kind of, you know, led me to air shows, led me to folks. I had a lot of flights where I got to explore that, and I kind of developed an interest in a really wanted to go do that. Mm-hmm. And as I kind of combined both the desire to want to do that and a desire to be a military officer, I thought the Marine Corps was the best place for my personality.
Yeah. How long were you in the Marines?
About 8 years.
What do you think that experience did for you? How did it shape you? What were the key learnings that prepared you for today?
I do think that the Marine Corps is great at developing leaders. I mean, from the day you are going through the selection to even be an officer, you're focused on whether or not you're going to make it a good leader. Can you be calm under pressure? Can you think strategically? Can you also deliver tactically, which is what I said earlier? And so I think that kind of leadership development was important to my personal development. And also, you know, just actually going through the process of making it in as an officer, making it through flight school, learning to land on aircraft carriers, doing those types of things taught me that I could kind of do the impossible. So you're sort of afraid of nothing, if you will. It's probably not the right way to put it, but effectively you're willing to take on those types of challenges.
But in the military, there's an established chain of command and order. In consulting, you've got to talk these people into it.
Yeah, there's not the same rank and file that you might have. And so you have to learn to gravitate between directing people that you might want to do when you're kind of in a military environment to learning to understand when you can get consensus from the group, when you can kind of help them understand how to make them arrive at the same decision you are already at, but how to kind of guide them towards that. So you can't just order folks around like you might do in the military because it was the right thing to do and needed to be done. I think here is a different environment. You have to change your management style to reflect that. And it took me several years to learn how to do that.
I was going to say, it takes a lot of discipline to do that.
And you have people who give you, I think, feedback in your career, both peers, both people above you. You know, they recognize your capability, and they kind of say, you could have done better if you had communicated this way. Maybe you can get everyone on board if you had talked about it that way.
But not everybody is willing. Not everybody is willing to listen to that kind of feedback. Yeah. Why are you?
I was reinventing myself. I was a very young fighter pilot, you know, and realized I wanted to kind of, you know, redo a career. And so I couldn't be a 31-year-old fighter pilot for the rest of my life. I had to kind of go start over. And so when you reinvent yourself, you were willing to listen to that and take that advice, how to be successful in that regard.
Where are you from?
I'm from Richmond, Virginia. Went to Virginia Tech.
Is that right? What were Mom and Dad doing?
Worked for the Department of Agriculture for the state of Virginia. World War II veteran, Pacific Fleet, and Mom was a homemaker.
Mm-hmm. And things were, I understand, pretty modest back then.
Pretty modest, yeah.
And what was it like growing up in those kinds of circumstances?
You know, I think they had the right values. They had the right, you know, wanted to make sure that we got the right education, pushed us towards that, even though my dad was a college educator, used the GI Bill after the war. My mom had not gone to college, so they were pushing us along that path, and I think that was a very important attribute.
You mentioned in the green room you spent some time working on a farm with your grandparents.
I did.
Yeah. Say a little bit about that.
I think that taught me the value of hard work.
How old were you when you were working on the farm?
Probably very young, and I don't remember. But
four or five?
But my memories of it started at like 10 years old, uh-huh. You know, when you're really actually out there helping out. And when you're a small kid, they're putting you on the back of a tractor and you're riding around and you think it's fun because you're going to go get a Coca-Cola. But, you know, when you're older, you're actually doing work, and you realize how hard it is that these folks work to do what they have to do for what's very little means. And you appreciate that, but then you also say, I want to aspire to something differently. And for me, that was... I think, a one element of many that probably said, I need to go to college. I need to kind of aspire to a different life.
Will you, as you build this business, are you going to look for people who have to reinvent themselves, or you want to build people from
I think at this early stage of growing this practice, I'm looking for folks who have successful demonstrated experience in what I need. So whether it's someone who's in a risk advisory type of a role, someone who's more of a financial management person, I'm looking for folks who bring that level of experience. Ideally, someone who's had an opportunity to work with the federal government in some way as a contractor or as an employee. And I think that's important because, we've borrowed some resources as we start up that come from the commercial practice, and they're always itching to go back. So they don't invest necessarily in the mission of the agency and the long-term perspective. And that's fine. I understand that. But ultimately, I will bring in folks who I think want to know more about how can I help veterans? How can I help the Park Service or whomever it may be?
Why did you leave the Marines?
After the Marine Corps, I wasn't augmented, which is their phrase for I wasn't a Naval Academy grad. I didn't have a full commission, if you will. Mm-hmm. So they let a number of us go after the first Gulf War, and opportunity to kind of start a new life.
Yeah, how'd you take that?
It's a challenge. It's tough. It's frantic, if you
will. Were you disappointed?
Slightly disappointed. Yeah. Slightly relieved because as a pilot, I was never home and had a young family and young kids. And for me, it was a good time now to kind of marshal everyone as a family and kind of move forward and
redo things. Other than the leadership training that you got, you didn't have anything other than aviation.
Well, I would say that you're part in the Marine Corps because it's a small branch of service. As a pilot, you still have a day job. And so I went from logistics, I went to operations. Mm-hmm. So you have leadership roles, and you may work a 12-hour day and spend 4 of it flying, the other 8 doing the real desk job.
Yeah.
Some people focus on intelligence, some on maintenance. You know, right. It depends on what their role
is. So you were preparing for what was next, even though...
You may not have known it, but you were.
Yeah. So what was next?
I worked for a small contractor here in the D.C. area who was focused on foreign military sales and working with governments who flew or had ships or submarines, similar to what they were working basically within cruise missile technology around embedded systems that helped with training and learning and simulation. And so I was hired as a subject matter expert for the aircraft I flew. I got to work with all the foreign militaries who flew that aircraft, and it was a great transition from the military to civilian life.
What would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is?
In a physical way, I think it is landing on an aircraft carrier. There's no doubt about that. At nighttime, that is one of the hardest things I've done.
Tell us about the first time you did it.
The first time you did it, you are as scared as you can be. But you ultimately, in the daytime, you get slightly comfortable, if I could say that way. At nighttime, you never are comfortable. So you're always on your game.
Yeah, your mom and dad aware of your success?
They are.
What do you
talk
think?
Regularly.
Yeah, what do you think they'd say if I was interviewing them?
I think they'd be proud of where I've gotten. And so it's a long change from where they were when they were growing up.
Jeff, what's the website address for Baker Tilly?
www.bakertilly.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Jeff Smith, a principal with Baker Tilly CPA firm. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Allaire with Buchanan Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me structure the interviews today. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Glenn Hazard, the chairman and CEO of Exedium, Paul Lombardi, the president and CEO of TerraThink Corporation, Therese Baker, the president of Abtech Professional Resources, and finally Jeff Smith, a principal with Baker & Tilly. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executivesleadersradio.com, for more information about our executive leaders. This has been Peter Schwartz. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual